sailors were killed. The ship and its survivors are still on their way to Mediterranean ports. NBC News correspondent Robert Gorowski reports by satellite.
This is the USS Liberty, the Navy ship that was strafed and torpedoed Thursday by Israeli patrol torpedo boats and Israeli warplanes.
Yeah, we'll come back now. And it turns out it was 34, not 33 men died, right? And I was going to ask you, I was trying to look real quick, was it Edwards or Norton or Travis Air Force Base, one of them?
It was Edwards. Edwards, thank you. Yeah, thank you for that. It was Edwards. Quite a few things were going on in the spring of 67 in the White House. And I think it's critical that we know those two. And that was the fact is that our good friend LBJ was absolutely beside himself with trying to figure out how he was going to win the election in 1968. I mean, he Vietnam was not going well, not going well at all, you know, and he didn't know. And of course, then, you know, you had the Tet Offensive in 68 and that hit didn't help him any. But I believe, and I think I can document the fact that after all of the fiasco and all of the cover up around the USS Liberty was the fact that Johnson decided not to run in 68, citing health issues. And I think the health he was worried about was his, if there was ever any full congressional investigation of the USS Liberty. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to get away from that. And he knew, he was afraid that his opponent, you know, maybe even Tricky Dick, might bring that up during an election campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took the easy way out. Well, there are so many things to look at here, Murr, but here was one that most people haven't even thought about. Murr, did you know that there were electronic collecting other naval ships in the area than the USS Liberty?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, there was, and you're probably not going to believe that they were actually under the water.
Oh.
There was at least two U.S. submarines in that area. And one of them was the USS Amberjack, and the other one was the USS Andrew Jackson. Oh. Now, the Andrew Jackson was a nuclear. It was equipped with nukes. Now, there is reports, and there were members of the survivors who years ago remembered this, and it is claimed by some folks I know, and they're pretty reputable people, is that the USS Amberjack had its periscope up during the attack and filmed the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, where's that located now?
I have no idea.
Where is the film of the attack on the USS Liberty? And if a USS warship was if a USS ship was being attacked and there was a submarine there, why did the submarine not retaliate?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't it become actively engaged?
It was going to be a sacrificial lamb, Liberty was, huh?
Well, I don't have any doubt about that, and I think everybody in the intelligence community knew it back then, too.
And they had to know they were siding with that happening, you know, since they knew mm-hmm. they're culpable. Yeah. Blackbird in the chat room here has something interesting.
Ooh.
Recall the 6 days of creation in Genesis. I've always wondered if the Sabbatean Frankists in Israel were trying to bring in their new world order in 1967 in the Six-Day War by triggering World War III, whereby the USA, NATO, and USSR Warsaw Pact would all destroy each other, leaving Greater Israel as the sole surviving world power. Several question marks. First deck of Tikkun Olam, fixing the world, is to destroy the existing world and replace it with a new world order. And, you know, it seems like it's been that way all through time. you know, even when they didn't seem to have nearly as much power as they do now, and there's more of them than they claim to. I mean, even this whole country's life, this beginning and all through this country, has been like a stepping stone toward that goal.
Oh, well, Murr, have you read, I hope I pronounce his name correctly, a Liberty survivor who wrote a book, one of the first ones, I think, was it Jim Ennis, E-N-N-E-S?
I've read some of it, you know, parts from it, but I haven't read the book, yeah.
Okay, well, I hope I got his name right.
It bothers
me if I mispronounce people. But anyway, have you heard of Charles Chuck Rowley?
I think I've heard the name. Deanna Spingola used to have a yearly, you know, thing.
Yes, I remember.
And Phil Turney had a show, so I remember some of these names, but please fill us in on the details.
Well, he was one of the Liberty's communication technicians, which means he was a spook. I'm not sure if he was an analyst, a diddy bop, or a translator, a linguist. But anyway, he settled in Sonoma, California, after he left the Navy, and began to tell his story after Jim Ennis started collecting evidence for his book. As he reported, Chuck had been on the open bridge of the ship with Ennis when the attack started, and he was taking photos for the captain with a Nikon camera when a bullet from one of the aircraft in the first strafing run smashed his telephoto lens, but it saved his life. Moments before, he had photographed the ship's flag flying in a light breeze and had showed his picture to the Naval Court of Inquiry, because Israel claimed there were no flags. Rowley was angry that when he handed over the film he had shot, they stamped it top secret and confiscated it from him. Later, a U.S. Navy captain ordered him, and I quote, "Shut your mouth and never, ever discuss this attack again." Mm-hmm. And we know, what was that wonderful admiral? He's Zorro or whatever his name was, the one that Kidman or whatever it was.
Kid.
K-I-D-D. Who went in and threatened the entire, you know, all of the survivors to keep their mouth shut.
Took off his stars and threw them on the table and heard all of their stories and then put them back on and got red faced and told him you better shut up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, here is something else, Murr, and this is something I noticed way back when. You know, I told you about the USS Amberjack being there, very possibly recording the whole thing. Well, did you know that somehow, ironically, the logbook from June to 8 June in 1967 disappeared?
No.
Yes. It just disappeared. Nobody knows why. And it wasn't. How convenient is that?
Yeah.
Well, Amberjack's presence in the area was very significant. If this submarine was on such a mission in circumstances when the war was imminent and with Washington fearing the Soviet Union might retaliate, if they were to believe Nasser, the Amberjack might have been needed just in case the war turned nuclear. Not many people realize that when an atomic bomb is detonated, radio signals in the area would be disrupted for several hours. Now, that is caused by the electromagnetic pulse produced by the explosion. Mm-hmm. However, submarines use a system called ELF, extra long frequencies, through the sea and through the earth. The sub could have been a vital communications link in the event of a nuclear attack. Now, why were they there?
In expectation of that happening, yeah.
Yeah. Well, on the night of the 5th of June, a submarine secretly transported a contingent of Israeli special forces into the harbor in Alexandria, Egypt. They were trained as powerful swimmers and sabotage experts, and their precise mission will never be known. They were supposed to be recovered by the same submarine at a later stage in the war, but unfortunately they were captured red-handed by the Egyptians. Now, what were they up to? That could be a good one. And Murr, have you ever heard of the 303 committee?
If I did, I don't remember what it was for, but please tell me.
Well, there is an executive office building across from the White House, and it houses a lot of intelligence operations, and plans are made for this and plans are made for that and what have you. And it got the name 303 committee because that was the room number. It was 303 in the executive office building. So they called it the 303 committee. Now, I know you've heard me speak of Colonel Fletcher Prouty.
Yeah.
Well, he spent the last years of his military service as the Pentagon focal point officer, through which all CIA requests for military assistance were channeled for the Department of Defense. But later, he became a real critic of the way the committee bypassed all of the controls that had been placed there for good reason. Now, he asked in 1975, what is this 303 or the 40 committee, which has this power over the non-communist world? Who are its members? Do they operate within any law? Whom do they represent?
Let me guess, they're communists.
Whom do they represent and whose interests do they promote? The power of this committee is awesome. Like the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, there is almost nothing in the world that cannot be done secretly by the might and the money of the government of the United States. The special group or 40 committee has become a power unto itself. The State Department has thousands of career people who are responsible for the foreign policy of the United States to the 40 committee's 5 men. They approve items that have much greater impact on world events than the State Department. They do this secretly, without proper review, without comprehensive experience, and often without anyone but a very few spooks ever knowing about it. Now, Richard Helms, director of the CIA in 1967, was quite candid when he was interviewed 35 years later about the 303 committee. And his response was, the 303 committee was simply a device for examining covert operations of any kind and making a judgment on behalf of the president so he wouldn't be nailed with the thing if the whole thing failed. Yeah, right. The names of two other submarines that, you know, I mentioned, you know, the Amberjack, and of course, I did mention the USS Andrew Jackson, I'm sorry. They emerged from contacts between Liberty crewmen and shipmates on other boats. The USS Requin, R-E-Q-U-I-N, whose logbook showed it was carrying out exercises with various navies off South America at the time, and the USS Parche, P-A-R-C-H-E, which one retired U.S. Navy intelligence officer said was not the culprit, though he added, I can tell you that it was deployed in the area and was equipped with an airlock system so that special ops frogmen could be released underwater to install electronic taps on undersea cables. We needed to listen to everything that was going on. The more intriguing possibility is that a much more formidable vessel, the Polaris submarine, the USS Andrew Jackson, had followed the Liberty all the way across the Mediterranean and was lurking in the waters very near when the attack began. Is it possible, therefore, that a Polaris submarine had been deployed to accompany the USS Liberty by this 303 committee? In the 1960s, the American ballistic missile submarine fleet was symbolic of America's resolve to outgun Russia. Sending one to the Sinai coast in conditions of great secrecy indicates that the Pentagon feared a serious threat from another nuclear power. Now, there are only two more nuclear powers there, Israel and Russia, right? The Soviet Union was one obvious contender, but actually, it was Israel, too. By June of 67, there is evidence it possessed at least two atom bombs of its own, and the Andrew Jackson may have been dispatched just in case trouble from either party should lead to a doomsday scenario. The Liberty was not sent alone, for the Pentagon knew that the CIA had aided Israel in acquiring their own nuclear capability, just like we did Russia. Moreover, the U.S. had provided the Israelis with missiles to which atomic warheads could be attached. Those were the old Jerichos. Thus, in case a bogged-down Israeli army decided to use ballistic missiles to win a war against the Soviet-equipped Egyptian army, the U.S. was in a position to warn both Israel and Russia that the introduction of nuclear warfare could produce an instantaneous retaliation. So, a little bit of description on the Andrew Jackson. It was equipped with 16 firing tubes capable of launching Polaris A-2s containing a W-47, a Whiskey 47 thermonuclear warhead with an explosive power of 500 kilotons, 40 times more destructive than the two atom bombs dropped on Japan in World War II. It also had four torpedo tubes and a range of torpedoes, including Mark 45 Astors tipped with Whiskey 34 fission warheads. On patrol, the vessel could operate for 60 to 70 days without surfacing and returning to base, and had a top speed underwater of 30 knots. It was therefore a constant readiness for a possible World War III, and under orders never to betray its presence by ever using terrestrial radio. The Liberty may have been the link to that outside world. So, to me, it's almost impossible to look at all of these prevarications. But then, Mer, you know, we've talked about this before, and, Blackbird 9 and I talked about this as well. And that was the fact that almost every politician of any power, of any authority in this country, has a Jewish handler.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them. I mean, you know, all we have to do is say Henry Kissinger.
Yeah.
You know, and Kissinger was a valued, not to me, of course, and not to America, but to our government, was a valued aide to eight consecutive presidents.
Yep. Heinz Loeb. The only one that didn't have him in there, kicked him out, was JFK.
Yep. Imagine that. And wasn't it George W. that wanted to put him in charge of the 9/11 commission?
Uh-huh.
Oh, and Democrats and Republicans loved him alike, huh?
Yeah.
Well.
Oh, you know what? I never announced. I probably should make it official that we're not taking any phone calls. I guess everybody's figured that out. But, yeah, there's just too much to cover.
Go ahead, Mike. And we ain't even going to get close to finishing it, sweetheart.
No.
But anyway, here we go. His dream, going back to Washington and that Johnson's reelection in 68, because I think this is critical, because he felt like that if he intervened in this six-day war, and maybe if the USS Liberty was sunk, which I think was the original plan,
mm-hmm.
to sink the Liberty and then to nuke Egypt, to nuke Egypt, maybe mm-hmm. Jordan, maybe Syria, but he was going to nuke them for sinking the USS Liberty. And considering that the last helicopters that arrived at the USS Liberty, which had the wonderful Star of David on them visible, and they were filled with troops ready to board the USS Liberty. So if you had accidentally destroyed, if you had accidentally fired upon this ship for 3 or 4 hours, not counting the fact that there were at least 10 overflies
mm-hmm.
before the first attack.
Right.
They knew exactly what they were doing. I mean, to me, as I said before, if you believe the official government story here, you're either an idiot or a liar. So Johnson's dream was to win again in 68, as I said before, and he worked feverishly to that end, regularly telephoning his political contacts to request or grant a favor, obsessed by leaks and paranoid that some of those near him were plotting against him, including, of course, his Attorney General, Robert Kennedy. He surrounded himself in the White House with people he felt he could trust and who would never talk to anyone. Now, LBJ was a driven man. Study his political career. You know, there, and he was working long hours, sleeping little, and bulldozing legislation through Congress more successfully than any modern president has. He also knew how to bypass Congress when need be, and sometimes just telling whatever lie he needed to tell to get whatever it was he needed to, whatever he wanted. When he was finally sworn in as president himself, a number of leading Jewish intellectuals and Zionists were very keen to serve with him. They formed an influential cluster of talent in his administration and helped him win the backing of the important Jewish community in the United States. His Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, grew to know LBJ well after he became vice president to John F. Kennedy, and he even admired his ability despite his homespun Texas countryness. In 1969, after both men had left office, Rusk recalled, "I never sat in a session with him about even the most complex and technical matters when I had any impression that he was failing to grasp all that was involved and was missing the key issues that were before him. That high intelligence was concealed, at least as far as some snobbish Eastern intellectuals were concerned, by a Southern accent and his Southern mannerisms. But he was a man of great intellectual capacity and had an ability to understand the issues that were in front of him clearly and in great depth." Now, there was a counterpart here. You know, let's look at the British for a minute, DW. Dennis Healey, who as British Secretary of State for Defense in 67, was Robert McNamara's opposite number in their government. But he summed up the president in five words. Lyndon Johnson was a monster. He wrote in his memoirs, "Johnson was one of the few politicians with whom I found it uncomfortable to be in the same room. Johnson exuded a brutal lust for power, which I found most disagreeable. When he said, put your finger in your ears here, sweetheart, but I'm going to do this quote. When he said, I never trust a man unless I have his pecker in my pocket. He really meant it. He boasted about acting on the principle, give me a man's balls and his heart and mind will follow.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but Dennis Healey, he was one of these big pedos.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt there.
No, that's all right. He said, I could never forgive him for the way he destroyed Hubert Humphrey's personality while Hubert was vice president, thus costing the United States what I consider to be the best president it could have ever had. Mm-hmm. In fact, Johnson's trust in most of the people he had not personally handpicked was legendary. Clark Clifford, counsel to the president and chairman of the Foreign Intelligence Board, explained how under Johnson's rule, the National Security Board met weekly. And here's what he said. If we needed anybody else, somebody might be brought in to brief us. But the president learned if you begin to talk about very important policies and begin even to make preliminary decisions when you got a whole group together like the National Security Council, you'd almost sure to get a leak somewhere. I think Johnson never had a leak. He also shut out advice from people who might be more inclined to challenge his viewpoint. He was happy about that. The spring and early summer of 67 was a time of particularly high tension in the White House, with trouble both in Vietnam and the Middle East, and with Johnson almost paranoid about protecting his re-election chances the following year. Though in a relatively low position as a staff writer there, one Grace Halsell has vivid memories of those weeks when she could sense events of a great portent were transpiring, and observed the glee with which reports of Israel's conquest were received in the White House.
Well, you know, and, Mike, too, I'm interrupting again, but if
go ahead.
Back to 1938, when he was a congressman, he led all the Jews, and it was called Operation Texas, right? Undercover operation,
yes.
To relocate all these. That's why you have Israeli Day and all this other stuff in Texas. There's mm-hmm. way more Jews than 2%. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll continue with that one. Yeah. He said, I was aware of that year's Middle East crisis, Ms. Housel wrote. But like most Americans, understood little about it other than the fact that it involved Jews and Arabs. And that year, I did not know a single Arab. And possibly LBJ did not know one either. Like most Americans, I was pro-Israel, Israel having been sold to almost all of us as the quintessential underdog. Everyone around me, without exception, was pro-Israel. At the very seat of American power, Lyndon Johnson surrounded himself with people who, to say the least, were far from impartial. Johnson had a dozen or more close associates and aides who were both Jewish and pro-Israel. Well, naturally they were. There was Walt Rostow at the White House, his brother Eugene at the Department of State, Arthur Goldberg, ambassador to the United Nations, other pro-Israel advisors, including Abe Fortas, we'll get to him, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Democratic Party fundraiser Abraham Feinberg, White House counsels Leo White and Jake Jacobson, White House writers Richard Goodwin and Ben Wattenberg, Domestic Affairs aide Larry Levinson, and John P. Roche, known as Johnson's intellectual, in residence and an avid supporter of Israel. Naturally, they were. They were Jewish. She often observed the comings and goings of Abe Fortas and Arthur Goldberg, and knew that Rostow, in particular, had close connections with the Knesset in Israel. She noted he often met up with Israeli embassy minister Ephraim Avron, Evron. There was also a strikingly attractive blonde woman named Matilda Krim, who was an ardent supporter of Israel and a very close friend of LBJ. No kidding. She held no official position, but could come and go at will in the White House. That's not exactly protocol, Miss Murr. Looking back and having taken the trouble to research events surrounding the war, Housel is now deeply concerned how partisan the U.S. was and how the Arab position was and how the Arab position was relegated. She added, I was at the time a typical American. I was convinced back then that the Arabs had started the war and deserved what they got, no matter what it was. Is that not exactly the same thing we're looking at today with the mm-hmm. Palestinians, Murr?
Yep. Yep.
Has anything changed except the year?
It's gotten a little more intense, I think. And their lies are even more intense, you know. It's just like in our faces. They don't care.
Well, she asked some important questions here that we all ought to ask ourselves when it comes to this liberty situation. She said, I didn't try to reason how, if the Arabs had started the war, they were surprised with their air forces still on the ground, and how it was that Israel so easily seized all of Palestine, including the rest of Jerusalem. Instead, like millions of Americans, I was thrilled by the might of the little underdog, Israel. Yet, despite the euphoria around me, what I saw in the White House planted many questions in my mind. As Americans, we had just passed through a dangerous Middle East conflict that threatened to explode into World War III. There were two parties to the conflict, Arabs and Jews. But for weeks on end, I had only seen one set of advisors who could call or see Johnson whenever they pleased. The Arabs had no voice, no representation, no access whatsoever. So, Murr, where you want to take it now?
Oh, I don't know. I was just, I caught Blackbird giving somebody a link to when you did Mike Addy sinks USS Pueblo brainwashing with him. Sounds like an interesting one. 1968. Yeah.
Well, you know, it was really simple because you and I both know I don't mention names, but I had had a discussion with someone who was telling me about, you know, oh, Israel, it was all a mistake. You know, they didn't mean to do that. It was just a mistake. You know, I talked to this Israeli guy and it was all a mistake. And I asked him, I said, well, Dave, where were you that day?
Mm-hmm.
And he said,
how old was he?
He was seven.
Right.
He had just turned seven.
That's his out. That's his excuse when it comes down to, I was just a little boy. I don't know.
Well, if you don't know, then shut the hell up.
Exactly. Exactly.
And quit, you know, calling all of these wonderful survivors, these men who did everything. You know, when you read their stories, every one of them should have gotten a Medal of Honor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were some cowards in there, and I've heard, you know, a couple of them talk about there were cowards, and there's always going to be because everybody's not going to be brave. But when you look at what all of these people did for each other, you know, to save each other, what they did under those kind of circumstances, and then you have some jerkwater idiot calling them liars?
Yeah.
And
it's
I don't know.
It's unconscionable, you know?
It's beyond, you know, the whole thing. Well, let me, to use the vernacular of the inner city, Miss Murr, let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of Operation Cyanide?
Oh, I have, and from you, I think, in particular, but I did read about it, but I need the details from you again. But we're about to go to the break, I think. I think this is the only one we have this hour. And
yeah. Well, and that
I don't hear the music yet, so shoot.
Well, I tell you what, to really do due diligence with Operation Cyanide, I think we should probably hold that one off until the next program, Murr.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Because I don't want to get into the really good parts and then have to drop it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay with you?
That's fine. That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, again, I just don't understand how people can look at the facts here. But, of course, you know, it's just like I've heard over and over from so many people. And they say, why do you even care about history? Man, it happened yesterday. It doesn't make any difference. Nobody cares what happened back then. Really? How do you ever keep up with anything? You know, if you don't know what happened in the past, you know, of course, that brings up, you know, that old quote, the good one. Yeah. People who are ignorant of their own history will remain forever children. And children are a lot easier to trick than adults, right, Murr?
Yeah, yeah. Their innocence is used against them, but they're very powerful. They're still very close to God's realm, you know?
Oh, yes.
And that's why these dark societies that are all joined under the Luciferian Brotherhood take them when they're like three or four and just, you know, fill them up with all this stuff. Okay, we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
One cloud was in the sky. I beheld the star of Ramphine with a million questions why. And every hole that tore my soul that day I still carry them with me. By sheer determination and God's grace I remain. But if it helps you sleep, you can picture me as anthem bottom of the sea. Then I locked eyes with the pilot, threw my fist into the air, 'cause I'd rather die in violence than cower at your sneer. I've held these wounds for decades in my heart, and while you keep them in the dark, you store up wrath that you cannot erase. No, it remains, but if it can picture me and the bottom of the sea.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Tom Bolton for Ease Off. I know so many of you are finding our Easy 4 carcass drop and lift an essential tool for your meat processing operation, but today I want to spotlight four of our new products. First, our right height hog cradles with steel or aluminum frames. Our customers love this back-saving innovation that enhances sanitation and speeds production. Next, our beef cradles with stainless steel or aluminum frames eliminate rust and corrosion. We hope you'll compare our quality and prices for this essential part of your processing line. Our cradles are especially effective when used with our power skinner. And finally, our hook tumbler will keep your hooks clean and polished. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff, LLC, 417-932-6419.
American Freedom News is your daily website that will keep you fully informed on what both the good guys and bad guys are doing in the information war in which we are all engaged. Fed up with the lies of the fake news media and the censorship of big tech giants? American Freedom News is the solution, as we provide truth and knowledge on all the vital issues of the day. American Freedom News believes in America first. The establishment wants us split into numerous hostile groups rather than uniting in a common cause against the corrupt oligarchy that is plundering America and the world. Many more Americans are waking up and realizing they are the victims of the ongoing Great Replacement and Great Reset. But the malevolent forces trying to systematically destroy America can and will be defeated. Be fully informed by reading American Freedom News, the best news and information site on the internet. Go to AmericanFreedomNews.us and find out for yourself. That's AmericanFreedomNews.us.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste for the price of a cup of coffee.
Hemppaste.com/RBN. Free shipping on orders over $50. See the banners for Hemp Paste at republicbroadcasting.org and visit hemppaste.com/RBN.
Then cower at your sneer. And I've held these wounds for decades in my heart.
Okay, let's jump right in. We're playing around here enough. Blackbird reminded, and just for an appetizer here, because I had forgotten, and in case anyone else had, Operation, and he put this in here before you said we'd do it later, Operation Cyanide was a clandestine plan between the CIA and Mossad to spark the Six-Day War and guarantee victory for Israel. So we'll get into that next time.
Oh, yes, and especially who the primary author of that was, that three-letter guy.
Three-letter first name? I put his picture where it looks like they're about to waltz, he and LBJ. He's like,
yep.
You know, they probably had some fruity relationship to the way it goes.
I wouldn't doubt that for as long as those two were together. But, Murr, I think, you know, with all of the stuff, no matter what we do, I think we have to get down to a bottom line question. Mm-hmm. And that is, if all of this documentation that has been suppressed, if all of these things we have talked about today, all of these official documents, you know, the NSA was ordered to destroy many of the documents that they accumulated on that day. And all of their agents at that time were told that no one can speak about this. You don't even mention the USS Liberty. Mm-hmm. For fear of being prosecuted. And they went into all kind of details on this stuff. Here's the question that I have. If the government's version is the truth, why did they destroy the evidence?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because if they're telling you the truth, if they're telling you, yes, this is what happened, Israel made a mistake, here we can prove it, I guarantee you, you would see all of the documents that would prove it. Documents are suppressed because they are contrary to the lie the government's telling.
Yeah.
I just don't understand why folks cannot think about that. Why can't you get that in your head?
Yeah.
That if the government could prove their point, if these jackass publishers could prove their point, they would have these documents out there. They wouldn't give you their opinion. They would provide documents like we've just done today, Murr.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, they know that the media, also run by the International Jew, will cover them, you know, to some extent, or just put up the same lies. And people are addicted to that. You know, they're addicted to that media. I know the CIA is supposed to be in charge of some of that, but they're bought out. Everything is bought out by the bankers.
Oh, yes. Well, they want complete control, Murr, and that is... And, you know, when you look at these situations, when you look at, you know, the actual words from Moshe Dayan talking mm-hmm. about how they provoked an attack,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then now if we would have known that, if we had have all been taught that they, hey, watch out for Israel, they provoke attacks. Mm-hmm. How many people would be supporting them now in Palestine?
Well, you know, Mike, back in medieval times, we were always trying to warn each other. They have a fountain in Switzerland that, you know, it's way up high, but it's of a Jew with the yellow hat, and he's eating babies. He has a whole bag full of babies, white babies,
yep.
right? And that was in mm-hmm. the, you know, 1500s,
yep.
right? And on the cathedrals, all these Judensal, right? Where they have a pig, and the Jews, all the things they're doing with the pig. I mean, all through time, we've tried to warn each other. It's only recently that they've got all the instrumentation that would warn.
Oh, yes. Well, Murr, there was no doubt. I, you know, from the very beginning, you know, even the guy who created the CIA, of course, that was just an afterbirth of the OSS. But anyway, even Truman, after the JFK assassination, said that he had made a mistake with the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
But there is documented evidence that the CIA was controlled. Of course, we know that the entire government during World War II was controlled by Marxists or Stalinists, whatever you want to call them. We know that FDR was not running the government. It was being run for him by his advisors, his handlers.
Right. And, you know, Truman, he was, and interrupting here again, but in Independence, Missouri, he was the head of the Masonic Lodge. But he was a Jew also. His middle name, Solomon.
Yes.
You know.
Mm-hmm. But he did, and, you know, did he do it for effect with the JFK assassination? Did he come out and say, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't have put these guys together? But here's the thing, and most people are unaware of this, and I know there's people going to tell me, you know, you probably need to go soak your head or something. But the CIA has controlled this country's military. They started off by just controlling the special forces branches of the military, but now they control the whole darn thing.
And they were supposed to be only out of the country, nothing within
out
the country.
Out of the country, exactly.
Yeah.
And they were designed, if you look at how they were not designed to go out and, you know, be involved in government or anything else. That was not their function.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Central Intelligence Agency. What they were supposed to do was to gather up all of the intelligence from the military and combine it into report form and what have you to give to members of Congress, the president, and what have you.
Yeah. But they're joined at the hip with the Mossad, right?
Well, you've got to remember that they, you know, they're right out of the box, they had Alan Dulles.
Mm-hmm.
And Dulles was, and there was no way, you know, Dulles was busy with, you know, the Bushes making sure that Hitler had plenty of money to keep World War II going. Because the longer the wars go, the larger the debt, the more taxes you have to pay.
Mm-hmm. But there's a little crimp in that too, isn't there, where Germany wrote off the debt and were usury-free for 10 years?
Yes.
So, I mean, they knew they would punish them afterward.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, yeah. When we have that wonderful comment, 1982, by William Casey, when he said that
Mike, it's February 81.
I'm sorry. Okay. 81.
Yeah, because it was first cabinet meeting, right?
Yeah,
and this Barbara Honegger wrote it all down. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we will know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. And, Murr, that is something that's just absolutely... Even the people who claim they're on our side, even the people who claim all of this stuff, if someone comes on the news, Tucker Carlson or somebody else, Glenn Beck or somebody else, comes on the evening news, it was Rush Limbaugh, and they said, and they could say anything they wanted to as long as it's what they wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And if the people who will tell you the media does nothing but lie, we'll quote their last lie to you tomorrow if that lie that they heard was one they wanted to hear.
Right. And it's like this stuff with Israel right now. It's just disgusting. You know, when I hear this on the Christian information radio, I just want to smash it. Because they're projecting what the Israelis actually do onto mm-hmm. the Palestinians. They're just trying to survive over there. They're not putting any babies in ovens and cutting their heads off. And they say all this stuff like, oh, you know, and then, well, it's all right. The Jews are going to come to Jesus eventually, you know, at the last minute, right? And it's okay. Well,
yeah.
Aren't we supposed to expose evil? What kind of Christianity is that?
Convenient Christianity.
Yeah. Yep.
And most people really enjoy that convenient part, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well, Murr, I tell you what, this has been a ton of fun.
Oh, good. And, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Sure, nice having you. Yeah, my mother used to accuse me of a convenient memory, you know. I had a good memory.
Convenient memory?
But, yeah. You know, but yeah, I always had a good memory, but when I was young, of course, I used it to my advantage. I guess.
Oh, well, here's someone else. That Matilda Krim, remember me mentioning her? Johnson's mm-hmm. blonde friend. She was a, as I said, she could go about the White House anywhere she wanted to, anytime, no worry about security checks or anything. But her husband was a guy by the name of Arthur Krim. And he, you know, he was only 20 years older than she was. But they made quite the formidable team. When war broke out in the Middle East, she was staying at the White House and was still there when the USS Liberty was being bombed. Now, Arthur was a wealthy film mogul, chairman of the United Artists, and a devoted Democrat. He was finance chairman of the party's National Finance Committee and ran the President's Club, a Johnson fundraising vehicle that on the 3rd of June had hosted a $1,000 a head dinner dance in his honor in New York City. Krim had made no secret from the outset of his Jewish background or his Zionist convictions. And he and Johnson became close political allies. Then they became buddies. And at Johnson's suggestion, Arthur bought a 150-acre estate next to LBJ's ranch in Texas and built a lavish mansion, ensuring the two friends were always side by side. Matilda's good looks, her intelligence, and her exotic background dazzled LBJ. She was an Israeli whose daughter, by a previous marriage, was about to serve in the Israeli Defense Force. However, she was not by background Jewish, but originally Catholic, and her commitment to Israel exhibited the zeal of a true convert. She knew many of Israel's leaders and military commanders, and helping Israel had become her mission. You think that may be why she had free reign in the White House?
Yeah.
But being born Matilda Galland, G-A-L-L-A-N-D, in Italy, her family moved to Switzerland where she became a Lutheran. But while a teenager in Geneva, she fell in love with David Dannon, a Bulgarian Jew who had been raised in Palestine. He was living in exile, having been identified as a member of the Irgun, the terrorist Jewish community, the terrorism group fighting for Israel independence against the British, allegedly. She said she viewed him as a heroic figure, being friendly not only with the Irgun, but also with the Stern Gang, another of the Zionist terror groups, which was headed by Yitzhak Shamir, later Israel Prime Minister. She married Dannon and converted a second time to Judaism. She later admitted to Arthur Donald Neff that she then became a gun runner, a seemingly innocent, petite, and pretty blonde who was in reality taking messages and explosives into neighboring France and Italy to be passed on to the Irgun terrorist. 5 years later, she had changed back again, taken a doctorate in genetics, divorced Dannon, and moved to the United States. On the 3rd of June, 1967, she was sitting beside LBJ at the New York dinner dance when they were interrupted by banker Abraham Feinberg, another of Johnson's friends and a big money raiser for the Democrats as well as for Israel. He was reputed to have raised large sums for Dimona, the secret nuclear weapons plant in the Negev desert. Feinberg whispered to the president that he had some important news from Israel. "Mr. President, it can't be held any longer. It's going to be within the next 24 hours. They knew the attack was coming, Murr.
Yeah, they planned it and wanted it to happen.
Yes.
And, you know, you never hear about their mistakes, right? But they make plenty. They just, you don't hear about them. If we were to unearth all the different things they've done and didn't get away with, you know, it would somewhat help cripple them. You know, if people knew that, because they kind of think of them as omnipotent, and they're not.
No, they make plenty of mistakes, but if you own the media, nobody tells about your mistakes.
Well, see, that's the thing people have to realize. Get away from the media. I've been saying this way back on Stormfront. That's the number one thing you have to do. You just have to, you know.
Don't
have
without
a TV in your house.
Oh, beyond a shadow of a doubt. And, gosh, Murr, we've about eaten up 2 hours here, girl. What do you say?
Yeah, no, we didn't waste too much of it. I didn't make you waste too much of it. But we'll be doing this again. This is fun. Yeah.
Well, I hope that if nothing else, and I think of this so often, I had a very good friend in Colorado. He happened to be a district attorney, one of the only lawyers I ever knew that I liked. He was a good man. He was an honest man. He was a family man. And I got to know him, and we spent a lot of time together. We both rode Harleys back then. But then one day he had to go someplace to go to court, and I had to be in the same area. He asked if he could ride with me. I said, sure, Jim, jump in. Of course, I would like to tell you folks that the Mexican mafia murdered him in 2010. But anyway, we were in the vehicle, and we were riding down the road, and we were talking about something, and Jim turned and looked at me, and he said, Mike, you know what I like about you? And I said, nothing. And he said, no. He said, regardless of anything else, you always make me think.
Yeah.
And the only thing I want to do, people, I don't want you to remember my name. I don't care if you remember my name for 15 seconds. But what I want you to do is think.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is our only way out of this, is to start thinking and stop feeling your way through history.
Okay, we're about ready to check out here. But I wanted to add, too, because I see a lot of contention in the chat room about Truman being a Jew. And Dr. Dave is the one that sussed that out. And you don't find it anywhere, actually. And of course, they hide anything like that. But I do think it's true, you know. So thank you for being with me, Mike. And this is great.
My pleasure.
Thank you, listeners. This has been a lot of fun. We'll do it some more. So, Posiba, das vidanya.
All right, take care, lady.
God go with you.
Thanks, producer.
You can picture me at the bottom of the sea. When I locked eyes with the pilot, threw my fist into the air, 'cause I'd rather die in violence than cower at your sneer. I've held these wounds for decades in my heart, and while you keep them in the dark, you store up wrath that you cannot erase. No, it remains, but if it can picture me and the bottom of the sea.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Paudi Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus does not grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit drinksupertea.com. The first word is drink, spelled D-R-I-N-K, then the word super, then the word tea. The complete website is drinksupertea.com. or call us at 818-965-9113, Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-965-9113. DrinkSuperTea.com.
You're listening to Republic Broadcast.